Yeah, so I wanted to tell you a bit about our work on using biology and biological materials as templates for design of materials that do interesting things. And I'll mention some about interactions of motors and filaments in some cases, although for the most part these are not active systems. These are mostly passive actuated systems, passive systems that we actuate through external fields like magnetic fields. And I want to tell you, I'd like to tell you two little stories. So one, looking at cytoskeletal filaments. So these are microtubules, and this is a small magnetic bead that's embedded in the microtubules. We've developed devices where we can move this bead with great precision. So we can see how the microtubule networks respond to the application of local force. And one of the things we're looking at here is trying to understand how stresses are transmitted across networks and how the network architecture and the connections between the different filaments give rise to different pathways for stress transmission. And both to understand how stresses may be transmitted in biological systems, but also to understand better how we can design materials, particularly soft materials, that that engage pathways of stress transmission that we control. So if we wanted to develop a material that allowed us to transmit force or transmit stress in a designed way, you know, how would we do that? And then the second is a much larger lens scale problem, as you can see here, that's related to how marine organisms like this mussel, which we can collect just off the harbor here, how they bind to rocks, and how the structures of these filaments and these adhesive pads that go down, how the geometry of this influences adhesion. So in both cases, we're looking at how the structural properties and the mechanical properties of the system give rise to high performance mechanics, right? And using biology as a template. And I think there's a lot of opportunities here to include not only engineering actuation through use of electric fields or use of magnetic fields, but also self-actuation through use of motors that are really unexplored. So I hope that we have some interesting discussions. And I know this is, you all know this, so I'll only emphasize sort of the biggest one. But I know you've probably looked at pictures of cells. These are some endothelial cells that are moving on a glass cover slip. And they're doing normal cell sort of things, right? They're crawling and they're going from rounded to spread and they're interacting with each other. And we could discuss for a long time exactly how they do this and why they do this, but I'd like you to take a step back for a second and just think about these as materials, right? So these are materials that are able to do this. And if I were to ask my engineering students, can you build something that does this? The answer is no, right? And part of it is because we don't understand the activity, which I know is the focus of this particular workshop, but then also we don't quite understand how to control stress transmission, and we don't understand how cell architecture and composition gives rise to different types of mechanical response. So that's really the focus of what we're doing. And the key, at least for the first part of my talk, is to understand connections between the molecules that go into building up these networks and then their larger scale mechanical properties. And we're going to focus on microtubules, in part because they're much less studied than actin networks. So lots of people, including Christoph's group, have done a lot of work on looking at actin networks and actin network rheology. Microtubule network rheology is less well understood. It's also a really nice model for rigid rods, right? So microtubules are incredibly stiff, and we can then use these as a model polymer in the rigid regime, which is difficult to assess through synthetic materials as well. So this is a part of the phase space for polymer rheology, which has been really underexplored. And of course, even actin exists and sometimes in these rigid bundles. So we're extracting kind of principles, design principles, that we can then use to understand lots of types of rigid systems. So we use the cytoskeleton as an inspiration, and we exploit the fact that proteins can build these networks, and we then make reconstituted networks that have very defined geometries and architecture. So we can take natural proteins and use them in unnatural ways to create connections between networks so that we can control the network architecture and we can also control the protein compliance. So the end goals, I guess, are to make predictions between mechanics and architecture. So you can see here, like, microscopy is really good now, both in terms of electron microscopy and optical microscopy. So our ability to just determine what the structures are is excellent. Our ability to then understand how forces are transmitted through those structures is much more complicated. And that's always going to be inherently complicated, but we're hoping that we will have a better understanding of, you know, when we see a certain structure and we know the composition, can we predict how stresses are transmitted? And then can we design biomimetic materials that have desirable properties? So to do this actuation, we're typically using magnetic tweezers devices. So these are devices where we have our sample sandwiched between two glass slides. I'm just showing one glass slide here. There's a microscope underneath so we can visualize the sample. And then above we have really strong magnets. So think of these as like really strong refrigerator magnets. And the way that we apply force is by bringing these magnets close to the sample. So as we bring these close down, the bead moves up. And we use super paramagnetic beads, and we tether them in some way to our system, or we embed them in our system. So the canonical approach here, which was taken mostly, started, I guess, by Ben-Simone and Croquet in Paris, was using this for DNA stretching. And people still do this. This is still the state-of-the-art technology for looking at DNA stretching. And we actually learned a lot of this technology in collaboration with Omar Salah, who's here in materials and who trained with that group. So the advantages are that you don't have an external power supply and you don't have any hysteresis. So if you have electromagnets, which is the other way to create controlled magnetic fields, you can get high field strength, but you sometimes have hysteresis, you can have heating effects, and you need external power supplies to be able to create all the currents. And here we just need to control one parameter, which is the distance between the magnets and the beads. So that's easier. We also get inherently constant force measurements, which for some of our mechanical characterizations useful. And we have fairly large separation distances between the magnet and the bead. But the disadvantage of these approaches, as they had been developed for DNA work, was that the forces were really small, like 50 piconewtons, right, which is tiny for cell studies or even for a lot of rheology studies. So we took the approach of redesigning this. We've done a lot of design work based on finite element analysis of the magnetic fields to understand how we can put how we can shape the magnets both by placing them in pairs, but also by using soft iron backings to focus the magnetic fields. So the hope is to take magnetic field lines that would normally not be focused down towards the sample and refocus them towards the sample by use of metals. So we've done a bunch of work on this, and you can see here. You may remember the force on a paramagnetic bead depends on the dot product of the magnetic moment of the bead and the B field, right? So this magnetic moment in the limit of high fields saturates to a constant and can come out. So then the force is directly proportional to the gradient in the B field. So we want strong fields, but we also want them to decay fairly rapidly. That's how we'll get high force. And these are curves that show these four very simple structures here. And you can see that from the magnets only gap, which is how we started from the DNA pulling work, to this case where we have included iron tips that focus down, we go from the black dotted line to the green line, and we get not only higher field amplitude, but we get a much faster decay. So we can very much control the magnetic field amplitude and also the gradients, and we can therefore control the force. So in this way, we were able to. This is a picture of one of the devices we have. We use four pairs of rare earth magnets. We use these iron bars. We actually use low carbon steel because it's easier to machine. And we have focusing tips here. And we can, with this one device, go in force ranges from piconewtons up to nanonewtons over separation distances of only about a centimeter. So we have like really exquisite control, and we can go to much higher forces than people have been able to do before. And not by coming up with new materials for magnets, rather just by reshaping these magnetic fields. So we've built this onto a microscope. The microscope has some other cool features. It has a very long distance motorized stage, and it's a very bright illumination source. We use a 3D tracking method that again was developed by Ben-Simone that allows us to take a 2D picture, but because we have slightly coherent light from the LED, we get a diffraction pattern, and these rings depend very sensitively on the height above the cover slip surface. So from a 2D picture, we get 3D information about where the particle sits.
I'm just curious, with that, as you're normally doing, so the force is basically causing that coming out of the bottom.
We have different geometries, but in this geometry, that's the case. And then the metric we care about is the rings, how much the rings are changing, because that's giving us the Z information. Yeah, it just depends on like where you place the magnet array with respect to the optical axis. So the placing it above is kind of nice because you don't have any geometric you don't collide with the objective at all, right? You're just sitting on top. So that has its advantages, but there are other times where we do sideways pulling in order to like take advantage of like a slice through a confocal or something, you know, where we can kind of pull on the side, or even a slice here, but we want to simultaneously measure like a network property, and we want to look at the changes in the network in the focal plane, and we want to pull partly perpendicular to the focal, like it within the focal plane rather than out of the focal plane.
Can you also get those high forces?
It's a little trickier just because it's harder to get the, like we can't, the geometry is a bit harder, the mounts are a bit harder, but we can get to, nanonewton, I'm not sure with the devices we have, but there's no intrinsic reason we wouldn't be able to do that. There are geometric reasons you can't do it. So for us, like one of the limitations is we often want to like, we're building portable devices that we can use on the core imaging facilities here so that we spend our time like developing these devices that cost a few thousand dollars, and then we can exploit, you know, the hundreds of thousands of dollars that have been invested in these imaging systems. So I can't necessarily just like cut a chunk out of the mount that holds the sample, because the facility manager is going to be really angry, right? so if I had all the money in the world to just completely do my own thing, then there's no reason that you couldn't get to such high pulling forces there. It's just the geometry of the system. It's not anything intrinsic about the way the magnets are formed. So we did a lot of it sort of secretly at the beginning anyway, but now she knows, we've published it, now she knows. Okay, so, and then we use kind of a moderate, I guess the speed here depends on your version of, on what your normal video rate is. So we're about 10 times faster than normal video rates, but we're a lot slower than high-speed cameras, so it depends on what you, it's a moderate speed data acquisition system. So this work was mostly done by my postdoc, Yali, and she was interested in looking at the connections between structure and mechanics in networks where she had complete compositional control. So these are microtubule networks. So for structure analysis, she used confocal and electron microscopy. And for the mechanics measurements, she used magnetic tweezers. And so again, I mentioned before that we use microtubules partly because they're underexplored in their rheology. And that's largely, rigid rod polymers are underexplored, right? I don't think there are any synthetic polymers where you can have such long filaments with such long persistence lengths. So here we have a 20 micron filament with a 1 millimeter roughly persistence length. They really act as rigid rods. This is a singly fluorescently labeled microtubule, and it's confined in almost two dimensions. The third dimension is big enough to allow diffusion, but small enough that it confines this shape. It's about 3 microns. And we can do spectral analysis of these modes to measure the stiffness, and we've done a bunch of that, and these folks are involved in it. I won't tell you too much about it today. The reason the persistence length is so high is that the radius is big, right? So this scales as the bending moment, effectively. So the persistence length is the length scale over which thermal fluctuations randomize the direction of the filament. So entropic contributions are really small. Bending is really important. Our microscale actuation induces non-affine deformation, so we have very local effects. That means that the microstructure is really important, and the use of continuum mechanics is maybe limited. And the applications, I think, are beyond just microtubules, but also to bundled actin networks. Scaffold materials, which for stem cell applications often use these types of fibers, and then also from the more engineering perspective, nanofiber composites. So this is the type of measurement that we'll do. This is a cartoon version now, right? I have my magnetic bead, I have all my filaments, and as Dan suggested, we pull up, right, by having the magnets above. So we can apply force pulses in a kind of off-on manner. The off here means the magnets are retracted so that the force is very small. And on means that I've pushed the magnets down so that they are at a separation distance that applies a meaningful force. So this isn't exactly instantaneous. This ramps up and ramps down based on the speed at which the magnets move.
How fast can you do?
We can, I think we're at 100 millimeters per second. Yeah, so we did some oscillations. In practice, the fastest you can do without kind of rocking the table is a few hertz. So, but I think that's, again, like that's, there are ways to get around that, right? By getting better damping in the system, and by having the motor we have right now, we optimized for fast pull over a fairly large distance so that we could get far away. You can get motors that are faster around a smaller range. So I don't think there's any intrinsic limitations to that. I think it's more about design choices and building the experiment. So these are the types of responses you'd expect. An elastic system would show the same type of behavior as a function of time. A viscous system would flow under force and then would not come back. So we're going to be looking at, you know, to what extent do we see this initial jump up, which is an elastic response, and to what extent do we see a recovery at the end? And then if we don't see that, we might say, well, that's more like viscous behavior as dictated by these really simple continuum equations. So entangled networks are soft solids. We can make networks that are isotropic and homogeneous. I won't go into all the details of how we did this, but this is hard. It's not that easy to make isotropic homogeneous networks of microtubules. It's harder to get magnetic beads that are distributed throughout. So we have some tricks to do this, and if you're interested, I can tell you about it afterwards. But when we apply a force pulse like this, we see that initial jump up, which is indicative of an elastic response, and then we see some flow. And when we take the force off, we see, again, a jump down. And it doesn't always return to its original position. And in fact, it usually has an offset. And we can measure both the distance traveled in this, what we call a creep regime, and the unrecovered distance here. And we can do time traces where we apply force pulses over time. And this is the typical way that we would do these experiments. I was very worried about loading history when we first started this. So I was very worried that we would, you know, if for instance, I started at high force and went down, or Yali started at low force and then went to high force and then went to low force again, that we would see very different behaviors based upon the history of loading in the sample. So we looked for that extensively, and we really didn't see it. And I think that's interesting in and of itself, the fact that these networks can heal, and we'll come back to that in a bit. But the way in which we apply these forces, the history in which we apply these forces doesn't appear to change the mechanical properties very much. Yeah.
For
very small forces you don't see creep, but for most of the forces that we've measured we do. So even for a few piconewtons. Yeah, I think it also depends upon like how long you leave this pulse on, because it's a matter of like whether it's measurable. I think it's a detection limit on the experiment rather than whether or not it's really there. But for the conditions that we've studied, we see creep.
So I can't think of it as a fraction. I
think of it as certain. Let's come back to it. I think that you're right, that in some cases it is like a fracture, but the forces that we're applying are enough to sort of start things going right away.
Do you see nonlinearity if you change the force?
No. No, let me come back. So we see. Yeah, so this is, I mean, this is as a function of D1, which is this original jump. I can do the same thing as a function of force. So we do see some stiffening at high forces, but if I then go back to the linear regime, I don't see that the system has changed. So if I was in this regime and then I came back and I studied here, I wouldn't see permanent effects of having gone to like a plastic regime and then coming back.
But it's okay, but you expect strain hardening, right, from active, but it may be different.
I think it's different. And it's because the strain hardening that you see in actin is mostly like transitioning from an entropic to an enthalpic regime. And we're already in the enthalpic regime because we don't really have large fluctuations, at least in the filament. So whatever we would have seen in terms of the actin strain hardening happens by thermal fluctuations effectively. So here I think what we're seeing is kind of a piling up of filaments in front of the bead. I think this is geometrically determined. Yeah.
How big are the beads again?
5 microns. And the mesh sizes are somewhere around a micron. 20 microns. On average, it's a distribution, but on average. This is the mesh size that we determined through confocal microscopy. Mm-hmm. So for these are different networks. These are different network concentrations, tubulin concentrations. And if we plot the data this way, they all seem to kind of hit this, you know, deviation from linearity at roughly the same strain. So this is one measure of strain. And the C here depends upon the concentration of protein that we have.
Okay. Number one is,
I hope I have three answers. Yeah, I think I have a picture that will show it. Yes.
Same question is, if you change capital T, you know, since there's this creep behavior,
yeah.
The question is, do you land on the same creep curve? If you make capital T twice, you know, this seems to have a long time, right?
Yeah.
So if I half that time, would you still sit on the same curve?
For the studies that we did, yes. But we didn't look at that extensively, and part of it was just that we have like limitations in how much time we can spend on the experiment and how long the proteins last. But it seems like yes, yeah.
And the second one is, Can the technique be modified with two beats in there?
Yeah, you can have multiple.
Measure spatial correlations.
Yes, we can have multiple beads, but they have to be kind of far enough apart that they're not influencing each other. So we haven't looked at that extensively.
It would be interesting, of course, to see the
yes.
correlations.
Yes.
Yes. You know, the, how long range the forces are.
Yeah. No, I agree. And in principle, that's possible. We haven't done it.
I mean, you want them to influence each other.
But you want the beads to influence each other, not the magnetic forces. You want them to
through the network. Yeah, so we have done some, we did some early on where we, and this was like we were borrowing from an old paper by, I don't remember the name, Emplar's group maybe, where they did effectively that in actin, right? They had one magnetic bead and then they looked at the entrained latex beads around. Yeah, it must be, right? That's always a good guess, at least if you're not sure. So a magnetic bead and then you have all of these entrained latex beads around and you can use that to map out the strain field. So we have some data on that, but we didn't go down that route too far, and partly because we found we could label the networks and we could look at the networks directly, although we're still, that's been complicated and I don't have clear data to show you on that, but I think by looking at the network itself, we should be able to map out the strain fields.
Why is that complicated?
It's just, it's more a workforce manner. It's not, I mean, given more people, we could do it. It's just that there's lots of things that I'm interested in and that we're doing, so yeah, it's not, you know, come and do a sabbatical. You'd be great. So.
The magnetic force would be that you get these magnetic forces.
Yeah, that's right.
So otherwise you can drop it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But
yeah.
So have you exploited the strong force limit?
So here no, but I'll show you. In some of the stiffer networks, yes. But yeah, that's absolutely right. So the other, I mean, there's other technical reasons for why building multiple magnetic traps is easier and cheaper and nicer than building lots of optical trapping devices too, which you could guess, right? So so here's creeping flow velocity as a function of force for the different networks that we see. It goes up as we apply force, but only gently, right? And the speeds are slow, so 10 nanometers per second. We see that when we go from less dense networks to more dense networks, the speeds go down, but in a way that's kind of hard to understand, and the 26 and the 50 are actually really similar. So we don't quite understand this, I will say.
Do you have any idea how the beads interact with the magnitude? I mean, what are the interactions?
Yeah.
You know, when you have these very high forces.
Yeah. It's a really good question. So here we can look with microscopy and we can watch as the beads bury into the network. And this is with a sideways pulling device at low force. And so you can see that there's a piling up in front of the beads. You can also see that the network's not attached to the bead, right? So it doesn't appear that there's adhesive interactions between the network and the bead. There's a little bit of a depletion layer here, probably, as you might expect. So I don't know, to be honest, what the interactions are here. Others have suggested, and I think our data is consistent with the idea that you have small adhesive interactions that are forming weak cross-linking bonds within the network. So even though we've purified out all of the maps to the best of our ability, and we think we only have tubulin, we do have salt, so we could have ionic cross-bridging through the salt, and there could be other proteins that are there that they're just beyond our detection. So I think we're doing as well as anyone does in that, but there's always the possibility of some small contamination which is causing cross-linking. So my guess is that there are adhesive interactions probably mostly due to ionic cross-bridges, but also potentially some small amount of contamination. And in actin, you can change the salt concentration. I'm sorry, Christoph, but in actin, you can change the salt concentrations and you can get at these ionic bonds, and a number of people have done that. In microtubules, the salt seems to do more to the filament structure. So if you change the salt concentrations, you do get at these filament structures. We've looked at removing the C-terminal end of tubulin, which removes most of the charge on the network, but we haven't gotten that to a point where we can repeat these measurements yet. So that's with a subtle lysine treatment for those of you that are.
Interactions between microtubules, not between beads and microtubules.
Yeah, I don't think there's too many. I mean, based on these images, I don't think there's too many interactions between the beads and the microtubules. But I think there must be some interactions between the microtubules themselves, right? It could be steric. It could be steric, and it could be like enhanced steric interactions because they're so stiff, so you don't have these like fluctuation modes. But in the case, we don't know. So we ask, you know, are there adhesive interactions? So to get at this in a more predictive way, we went to an extreme where instead of having entangled networks with some unknown interactions, we went to very strongly interacting cross-linkers using biotinylated tubulin that we can incorporate along the microtubule length, and then streptavidin that forms these cross bridges. And here we fixed the tubulin concentration. We've also fixed the ratio of streptavidin and biotin so that it's 1:2, which is what you need for these cross-linkers. And then we can change the amount of tubulin dimers that are biotinylated, and that's a number I'll call R, a ratio I'll call R. So 25% here means 25% of the tubulin dimers are biotinylated. And now you can see you get very different structures, right? We still have magnetic beads in the system, but we have this phase separation between like polymer-rich and polymer-poor regions, and we can probe the mechanics of these dense networks. The beads tend to be localized in the polymer-rich regions. These, I should say also, like the behavior of these is really interesting. Like these structures, this phase separation occurs almost immediately. So you mix everything together on the slide, and you go to the microscope, and within like the minute that it takes you to walk across the room and focus, 2 minutes, these structures have already begun to form. And then they coarsen over time, but they form very quickly. And I think it's likely because biotin streptavidin is so strong, has such a strong affinity, that you get kinetic arrest of a structure that's out of equilibrium, and it never really gets back to its homogeneous state. Like you're always kind of stuck in this phase separated state. So we can do the same type of force ramps, right? And you can see even here at small forces, like some of them don't creep quite as much, right? Although some of them do. But at higher forces, we see more creep. And we also see, in this case, much more like jumpy interactions, which suggests that we're actually breaking bonds as we're applying the force. And this is not a characteristic trace. This is one of our jumpier traces because I want to show you the fact that you can see these staircase type of jumps. Sometimes we see that when we've turned the force off, the bead gets stuck in some like transiently formed microstructure that eventually breaks back and lets it return to its original state. But
so do you know how much, like the way you were describing was kind of visioning that, like those jumps being due to the bead, But from your images, stuff is very homogeneous. And so I imagine that a whole domain is somehow moving. Do you know?
Yeah, so we haven't. Yeah, so we haven't. Yeah, I don't know, I guess. I guess we don't know because we haven't been able at higher forces, which in higher forces is where you get to these cases. We've just recently developed the instrumentation that would allow us to do that sideways pulling with the higher forces, and we haven't gone back to look at this system. So I don't know which it is. I will tell you that I'll show you some more data that I think suggests that we're breaking single bonds of biotin streptavidin, and I suspect we're breaking them at the site of the bead. But yeah, you're right, that we haven't looked at like the whole structure to tell the difference between like domain reorganization and single bead motion. We just haven't done it. It kind of gets back to your question too of like what's the long range effects in the sample, and like when you apply stress in one area, how does that move across the sample? So I think we have the ability to do that, but we haven't done it yet. So now again, we see a nonlinear elasticity. This is again stiffness, right? So we see an increase in stiffness. We don't see any linear regime, but we see an increase in stiffness and then a softening. And I'll come back to why I think we see this softening. It has to do with bond breakage and the fact that although I'm saying this is an instantaneous jump, I'm actually ramping up the force because of the fact of moving the magnets. So I think this is actually breaking bonds during the force ramp on. The stiffening is perhaps due to piling up of filaments in front of the bead again. But we see the same general type of behaviors that we saw before. We're going to characterize them in the same way. The forces we're getting to here are beyond what we can do with optical traps. So at these higher forces, we're getting to 150 piconewtons. And I'll show you a case later where we get to like 400, 500 piconewtons.
This is total force divided by total displacement. It's not that bad for another user.
It is the force applied divided by this initial jump distance. And we've done, there are different ways to sort of characterize what this instantaneous jump is, and we don't see huge difference. Nothing really changes. It all scales, right? So you can either look at the displacement trace and try to see where you get, where you go from an instantaneous jump to something that starts to turn over, or you can just trigger on the force and indicate the trigger this displacement based on when the force hits its equilibrium position. You get basically the same answer in both cases. So now if we look at creep velocity as a function of force, I've plotted this differently. I've plotted the natural log of this velocity as a function of force. So now we see straight lines on the log ln plot, which suggests this is exponential. So an exponential increase in velocity as a function of force would be consistent with bond breakage, right? It would be consistent with the idea that I'm loading a bond, and in loading that bond, I tend to increase the off rate, and I increase it in a way that is scaled by a Boltzmann factor, where this is the applied force, and XB is the distance to the transition state on the energy landscape of the single molecule. And this is, I mean, a lot of people have shown that this is more complicated, even for biotin's streptavidin, that these rates depend upon force in more complicated ways. But a simple modeling and the early papers on biotin's streptavidin, which I think are the ones that are most relevant to compare to, also saw a transition around 65 piconewtons with one distance to the transition state before, and then a hidden well that comes out at higher forces with a lower distance to the transition state, which is consistent with what we're seeing here. And we, if we extract the distance, we're within about a factor of five of this. So this is, you just remember, you know, this is what this means, this distance to the transition state, that you go from a valley to a peak here, and when I apply force, I'm tilting the energy landscape and I'm increasing my escape time, and that comes up here in this Boltzmann argument. And Bell, we're using the simple old model that Bell has. There are lots of people who have refined this for single molecule measurements, but in the simple picture, this is what we see. So at first we were like, so I did this work. We did this work in collaboration with Alex Levine, who did some of the theory. And when we first saw this, we were like, oh, this is awesome. This is just what we would have expected, right? We put all these bonds in. Now we're breaking the bonds, and now we're seeing the bond kinetics come out in the mechanics, and we're even getting like these distances that are really similar to what we'd expect. We got force transitions that are at where we'd expect. And then we thought about it and we're like, hold on, because we have a 5-micron bead and it's embedded in a like fairly large chunk of network. So when the bead pushes on the network, it's not pushing a single bond, right? So why on earth are we getting the same data that you would get from like a single AFM pull on a biotin streptavidin bond? So you do what, like, I don't know, what I've learned faculty always do, which is go back to the student and say, you have to do it again. So she did it a lot more. And I mean, we see this is what we see, right? And we see that we get, that the forces that we apply to the whole system are consistent with the transition forces that we see are consistent with the transition forces that you see on single molecules, and that the distance to the transition state for these different numbers of bonds, right, because we're changing the biotin concentration here, also give us the same, we get the same slope, right? So we're getting the same distance to the transition state. So our interpretation of this is that we're loading single bonds, right? So this is a very rigid system. The microtubules are really rigid, the biotin streptavidin is really rigid. So as we're applying force, we basically load one bond to failure, and then we engage the next, and then we engage the next. So we're distributing the force a bit around the surface of the bead, but not much. So we're not really engaging most of the network. Most of the force is localized near the bead. And there are, you know, we're basically just kind of opening a crack and propagating that crack through the system rather than engaging a large fraction of bonds. We can also look at the recovery after applied stress. And if you remember, there's a distance here where we can look at the distance it's moved during creep and the distance that it has not recovered. And we can compare these. In a viscous system, if we had a liquid, these values would be the same, right? The only thing that you lose is the distance that you've moved during the creep regime. And yet we always find that this value is less than one, particularly at high force. So that suggests that this has moved back towards its original state better than you would have expected, right? It's moved more towards its starting state than I would have guessed based on how much it moved here during creep. And I don't know. Yeah. So through simulations with Alex's group, also, we understand this as the fact that the microtubules are so long and their persistence length is so long that even though we're pushing them in the middle, their ends remember where they started, right? So as long as we have some number of original bonds along the microtubule that persists, that's remained, even if we break a bunch and we move the filament a bunch, when we turn off the force, it's not just the fact that the bead has moved through the network, it's the fact that the filament itself remembers its original conformation. So the filament itself will push back. So you get kind of a super recovery because this is not we're not losing information in the system due to hydrodynamics, just due to friction through the system. We're retaining some of it because we've bent this filament that wants to return. So the elasticity of the filament gives us some level of recovery back and suggests that these systems are more resistant to fatigue and to repeated loading than we would expect. And I think this is why, even in the entangled case, we see less dependence on loading history than I would have thought, right? Because the filaments themselves remember their starting state and want to return to that starting state.
In other words, it's like the filaments are elastic and not purely viscoelastic.
Yeah, and even the viscoelastic, like I'm not, I mean, if I were to extract a viscosity from here, I don't know what it means, right? I think that this rate depends upon bond breakage kinetics.
Yeah,
so it doesn't necessarily,
but
yeah, I mean, you could, but it's a viscosity in a way that is, it's a viscosity that doesn't require liquid.
It's not against the water that you're dragging, but you're dragging against the failure of the filaments of the cluster.
Right.
But it's you're dissipating energy.
I'm dissipating energy by the, as each bonds break, I dissipate the energy. But it's not all lost, because some of the energy, when it breaks, gets transferred to the remaining springs. So it's like, you know, it's like if I had a mattress, like an old mattress, spring mattress, and I pulled the mattress up and I clipped some of the springs, right? I would move a bit because the springs stretch, but a lot of that energy would go to the other springs. So when I release it back, it goes back to its original state. So there is some dissipation. We don't recover everything, but there's a transfer of elastic energy that's occurring that I don't think the common way that people think about viscoelasticity describes. So it's a bit more complicated, and it's a bit more solid mechanics than it is hydrodynamics or viscoelasticity. The energy accounting is different. Yeah. Yes, I think it does. I'm not sure the same bond reforms, but I think an equivalent set of bonds reform, and that's why we see the fatigue resistance. Yeah.
Because the bond, presumably, these filaments are not straight, but they have all these bonds that are...
Yeah, they're a bit tortured, right. And I think the bond breakage explains this softening that we see at large forces, because we have a finite loading time, and during that loading time, we're breaking some of those bonds. So this is, we do not recover this in simulation, because in our simulations, we can instantaneously apply force. So what if we use more compliant cross-linkers? So instead of biotin-stripped avidin, we can use kinesins as cross-linkers, and we're only using these as static cross-linkers. We're not introducing ATP. We don't have any motor activity. And we can use two different types of kinesins. The K here stands for kinesin, and then this is the number of amino acids. So they have a different length, right? They have the same binding domains, or almost the same binding domains, but they have a different stalk length. And in the presence of AMP-PMP, which is a nucleotide analog, they bind strongly, but they don't walk. So these are just strong, these are just bonds. They're cross-linking bonds. And we can control their length, so we can control their stiffness. And this is just to remind you of the old data that we had, right? So we see this peak in stiffness. We saw for a biotin-stripped avidin bond, where the force to break the bond was about 100 piconewtons, the maximum forces that we got were, you know, of order 100 piconewtons. So that's the range of force that we could apply, was the range of the force to break a single bond. For kinesins, that force is more like 10 to 20 piconewtons. So that would suggest that when we add kinesins, we would apply much smaller forces, right, and before we start breaking the network. But these are much more compliant. So if my idea is that, you know, when we apply force, in the rigid case, we're really only loading one or two bonds to failure. In this case, where they're compliant, we might be able to engage more of the network, spread the force around. So even though the stress to fail for a single kinesin is an order of magnitude lower, we might actually be able to apply much larger forces in this case. So here's stiffness as a function of force for the two cases, right, for the two different motors that we have. And you see that we go to much higher forces, right, 200 piconewtons, even 500 piconewtons in the case of the longer chain. And we don't see a stiffening response. We see very linear materials. So we get this extended shear regime and this extended strength, right, the maximum force that you can apply is a measure of strength, right, or a measure of yield. So we're seeing that the materials are much stronger, even though the single cross-linkers have a much lower force to unbond. And then the velocity here looks much more like our entangled case, where we're not seeing that characteristic exponential behavior that we saw in bond breaking. Rather, we're seeing just this slow increase in velocity, and the velocities are fairly small. So So this is consistent with the idea of load sharing, spreading the force out over more bonds. It's never that easy. We also get bundling when we add the kinesins. So in the entangled case, if we look through electron microscopy, we mostly see single filaments. In the case of kinesins, we see more bundled microtubules. We see a small amount of bundling with streptavidin, but much more in the case of kinesins. So we're actually not sure how much of this is due to load sharing and how much of this is due to changes in the overall architecture, and we continue to sort that out.
Is the bundling also with non-dimerized kinesins? Because if you have AMPP, do they also bundle?
We haven't looked. I haven't looked. So like to leave, I don't think she's looked.
You have biotin and the C-terminus and you use streptavidin, but if you leave off the streptavidin.
Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, I don't think that she's looked at that. She's looked at the case where there's no kinesin, there's only the streptavidin, and then she does see some bundling, but not this much. But it's also really hard, like to say like this much of bundling is also really difficult because it depends on where you look, and it's, you know, there's only so much you can do in the, you know, you can also see like here we have some protein aggregates which are forming, and that's because she avoids all centrifugation steps once she adds the kinesin, so you can't get rid of the globular protein in a way you normally do. So these structures just don't look quite as nice as they do if you're working in an entangled case where you can have centrifugation steps to get rid of the soluble protein. So the summary of this part is that, you know, we can modulate these crosslinker properties to enable control over force. And we've done this in a network of rigid filaments, and we can see that the rigidity gives rise to interesting materials properties that at least to me were unexpected. And that suggests that, you know, there are new pathways to design of materials and also to understanding load sharing across cells that maybe have been underexplored. And in particular, we see that these rigid bonds can break and that they open, you know, what I think are effectively small cracks that relieve stress, and that the elastic energy can be transferred and as you said, bonds can reform. So the compliant bonds seem to share loads with the caveat that it can be difficult to change mechanics without changing bundles. And then this creeping flow, you know, it's not always flow, or at least it's not always hydrodynamic flow in the way that we think about this in rheology. And this suggests some new avenues for materials design. So in the last few minutes, I'd like to, so these are the people who've done this work, especially Yali, and Nick did a lot of the work for the magnetic tweezers, as did June. But I'd like to tell you about some newer work in my lab that I actually think I didn't expect it to have connections to the cytoskeletal mechanics work, but it actually, I think, does tell us things about materials design and how forces are transmitted in materials that are relevant to this idea of creating structures and using geometry to be able to influence pathways to stress transmission. So this is a picture of a muscle, right? So normally in like the cytoskeletal mechanics world, if we talk about muscles, we're talking about, you know, skeletal muscles in our arm. These are the muscles in the ocean that you might eat or you might admire depending upon your interests. And they have these long threads called Bissell threads that they form to form attachments either to rocks or to each other in order to live in colonies in the intertidal zone. And these are very common, and you see them quite a lot off the coast of Southern California here. They form these threads using an appendage called a foot, which comes out, it kind of looks like a tongue. It scrubs a surface, and then there are two shafts inside this foot that allow for injection of polycationic and polyanionic polymers down the structure. It forms a liquid-liquid phase-separated coacervate solution that then solidifies, and the foot retracts, and you end up with this injection-molded thread. There's a opening at the bottom of the plaque, at the bottom of the foot, that forms a plaque. So the structure kind of looks like my arm, like a thin arm going down, and then a plaque at the end, right? And the thread's actually a little bit offset from the center of the plaque, which is this rounded part. They make this in like 2 minutes, and they can make glues that are way better than what we can make. So from a chemistry perspective and from a even bioengineering perspective, like our ability to make wet adhesives is really tough, really not as great. And yet, like marine organisms do this all the time, really fast, in ocean water, under waves, when like birds are ripping them off the rocks. So we look at them for inspiration. This is a picture that I grabbed from a website because I thought it was just so cool to see the ocean waves kind of pouring over this colony of California mussels just south of here in Little Corona del Mar. So So what we would like to do is be able to understand how we can do this better, like how we can make adhesive structures. And these are useful for lots of applications. Like, as you know, we have a lot of underwater pipelines that carry cables or carry liquids, oils, and they sometimes leak and they need to be repaired. And those repairs are complicated, right? They're done by divers who have respiration tanks and are dealing with injection of adhesives under difficult conditions. And these are there are pathways to improve this. For instance, you know, these adhesives need to be applied within like 40 minutes of initiating the tank. And if you can't get it done within 40 minutes, you have to start over. They're also used for surgical glues. So sutures are one way to close up organs, but it's also useful to develop other means to provide stitching of samples, particularly if we can come up with glues that allow for development. Like you could have a surgery that has a glue in an infant state, and then it allows the tissue to move through stretch properties. So there are some glues actually based on muscle chemistry that have been used in this regard, and also for adhesive hands for robotics. And this one's particularly of interest to me because we're interested in the geometry of these adhesive surfaces, and not just the chemistry, which comes into play in a liquid adhesive, but also how you make a structure. So how do we understand these design principles, and then how can we manage them? So I've already sort of explained this to you, right? There's this foot, there's a depression. That depression allows a plaque to be formed. We're going to call this large circular thing at the bottom a plaque, and then there's a thread that goes up. And the muscle spends a lot of energy making these types of adhesive structures. So about 10% of their metabolic energy goes towards this. So it's presumably a fairly optimized process. And the interesting thing is muscles can't prepare their surfaces too much in advance. They just take what comes their way. So this is optimized for attachment to foreign surfaces. And if you've ever like worked in harbors or worked around boats, you know that you can't keep the marine stuff off the surfaces, right? There's barnacles and there's mussels and there's all sorts of stuff that comes and binds to your surface. But if I'd like to paint my boat, I have to rip it out of the water, clean everything off, strip the paint, provide some sort of primer, then paint it, then wait for it to dry, then put it back in. It's a very intensive process. And yet these organisms can apply adhesives without any preparation at all. So even though we do know a bunch about this chemistry, a lot of the proteins that are involved in this plaque are known. These plaques are acellular, but they're very protein rich. There's collagen in the thread, and then down in the plaque there's a series of muscle foot proteins, which is what this MFP is, and there's a distribution of proteins throughout the sample. These have been done by brute force biochemistry, where they just like chop up the plaque and then they do a lot of gels and westerns to be able to mass spec to be able to figure out the distributions. If you look structurally, the plaques have this foamy structure, right? Where you have, this is a plaque that's been cleaved and then like frozen, cleaved, and now we're looking at EM to see the structures, and you can see that there are cavities that are in this case filled with air, but likely in the plaque filled with some fluid, and that there are different distribution of pore sizes depending upon where you look in the plaque, and also there just seem to be kind of a biphasic distribution. We may be seeing here the solidified phase of one of the coacervid phases. So one of the liquid-liquid phases has solidified. So the primary question we have is, how are these properties optimized for adhesion? So we built a load frame, which allows us to, here's the cover slip, we would have a plaque which goes down and a thread which comes up here to a clamp. We have a force sensor in line with the motor, and we can apply loads and we can measure the forces. We have two cameras, one which you see here, which looks at the side, and then one underneath, which is a microscope that allows us to look at the debonding surface. So we're able to pull on a plaque. We can image the side view of the plaque so we can see this structure, and then we can also look underneath and look at the debonding. And we can vary the pull angle, and we can, this pull angle here, and we can vary the pull speed. So here's a characteristic picture of what we see, right? As this pulls, we see that we put black nail polish on the muscle so we can measure the strain of a specific area, and we can also measure the force. So this is force versus plaque strain as measured by the motion of this fiducial marker, and these asterisks are where we see debonding by looking underneath. But you can see that the plasticity, right? So you have sort of a linear regime, and then it tends to be plastic. So that plastic regime or that dissipation tends to happen before we see debonding. So there's something that's happening in the structure before it just lets go of the surface. We also see several different modes of failure. We can get an adhesive loss where the plaque separates from the glass, or we can get cohesive failure where the plaque tends to fall apart, right? Either because it has a hole that forms in the center, or because we get a tearing from the outside in that propagates down to the surface. So we're able, this is a typical type of experiment that we would do with these different attachment modes. So in this case, we measure force as a function of displacement. Christoph, you'll appreciate this. The forces are in newtons and the displacement is in millimeters. So my life is somewhat easier in this experiment than it is in some of the others that we've done. So we can look here what happens. You'll see initiation of debonding and then a circle that grows until eventually we lose the entire structure, right? So we have a cavity that forms and grows, and that grows by a center-initiated crack. So we get a crack here at the center that grows. If we have cohesive failure, that looks more like this. The system just kind of falls apart. And the force versus extension behaviors look the same in all these cases, and it's because they're mostly dominated by the thread mechanics. So just geometrically, you would expect that. The threads are about 20 millimeters long. The plaques are only, 2 millimeters high. So most of this extension behavior comes from the thread. People have characterized this extensively before, and we don't see anything particularly new. So we focused here. What's that?
The threads don't break?
The threads sometimes break, but not that often, and that's not what we care about. So we're only looking at the ones here. It turns out if you keep the threads hydrated, they tend to break more, which we found out. Just by good luck, that if we hydrated the plaque but we didn't hydrate the threads, then the threads tended to be stronger. And then we have this last one where you get a plaque that happens from the outside and then peels across, right? So you can sort of see what's happening here. You see, it's not quite clear what's happening at this place, but then from these combination of pictures, you can start to see, oh yeah, like it's ripped from the outside and now it's actually peeling the way I would peel tape off a surface. So we get these three different modes. The modes, it turns out, depend upon the angle at which we pull. So we have adhesive failure at all angles, so that's the failure from the glass. But at extremal angles, we'll get two different types of cohesive failure, either failure at the internally or a peel failure at high angles. And I think this makes sense, right? Because adhesion, like if you have tape, if you have like a piece of scotch tape and you pull up, not so hard to pull up, but if you pull in shear, you can like almost knock the table over, right? Like adhesion in shear is actually really strong because of friction effects. So adhesion here is really strong at these low angles. So it's so strong, in fact, that before we lose adhesion, we tend to just pull the whole thing apart. And then the adhesive failure, you can see these collagen threads, and they tend to have a natural angle that comes down to the sample. And that's because of the way the muscle makes the plaque. So this natural angle is about 40 degrees, 45 degrees. So if we're pulling along that natural angle, these tend to be like reinforcement bars that handle the stress. But in these high angles, we're actually kind of pulling back. Like we take the natural angle and we pull it back in the other way, and that allows for a crack to form here because we're putting these fibers that are optimized for tension in a high bending configuration, and we think that causes an outer plaque tearing. So the detachment force also depends on pull angle, and as you might expect, we get higher forces at smaller, more shallow angles, and the force failure here is due to loss of cohesion. So an interesting thing, if you just think of like just adhesion, the enhancement in detachment force at low angles is really high. It's much stronger than this like factor of two that we're seeing. And it's because the system just falls apart. So it appears that muscles have optimized their structure to be able to withstand about 2 newtons of force. And if you get, if you have adhesive forces that are stronger than that, they haven't really optimized their cohesion. So they just tend to fall apart. And if you pull at high angles, they just tend to fall apart. And for these comparisons, we found that the detachment force scales with the plaque diameter. So we rescale this in a dimensionless way to take account for the differences in plaque diameter that we see, and there's about 100 data points that have gone into here. We have muscle labs here, I should say. So we do this work in collaboration with Herb Waite's group, and he has tanks. We have a building at the end of campus that's actually sort of worth going down and seeing if you haven't seen. That's the Marine Biotechnology Building. It's plumbed with seawater. It sits on the edge of the Pacific Ocean, and it's one of the best places, I think, at least in the U.S., if not in the world, to do this type of marine research, because they're literally almost in the ocean, right? I mean, and they have access to seawater just by turning turning on taps. It's also because, you can imagine, because of the salt conditions, like everything's kind of rusty and gross. So even though it's one of the like really premier marine science labs in the nation, it's also sort of looks like it's falling apart, and it always looks that way because if you're in the ocean, that's what happens. We can also measure fracture energy. So fracture energy is the amount of energy it takes to make new surface, right? So it's like a surface energy, but it takes into account any sort of dissipative mechanism of the structure. So any dissipation of energy of the structure gets measured in fracture energy. And we can do that by peeling off a strip of the muscle. So we take the muscle plaque and we use a razor blade and we cut it so that it's a finite width here, and then we peel it off the same way that we would peel off scotch tape, right? But we peel it off a cover slip instead. And then you can, if you plot this in a specific way where you look at the attachment to this critical force for peeling, where you get the propagation of the peeling wave and you normalize by the strip width, and then you normalize by the pull angle in this specific way, the slope of this line gives you the fracture energy, and we measure something that's about 100 in units of joules per meter squared. And the interesting thing is, you know, Jacob Isercivelli's group and others here on campus have done a lot of measurements of the surface energy of these proteins using techniques like the SFA, and they measure something that's much less. So we're at 100 joules per meter squared, and they're at like 10 to the minus 3 joules per meter squared. So something about this structure allows us to get much higher fracture energies than if we were just studying the surface. And it's hard to go from, and if you ever talk to Jacob, you'll know for sure, it's hard to go from force to energy without knowing something about Lenz scales. But there are, for these mushroom geometries, which is what this is, scalings between force and energy that go as the square root. So if we assume that the mushroom geometry will give us this type of scaling, then we get the 4 to 6 orders of magnitude enhancement in fracture energy would give us 2 to 3 orders of magnitude in force, right? So we'd be getting almost 1,000 times more force because of the structure that's formed here, rather than just having this interface. And we can do our pull experiment. We can compare that to our peel test. The pull experiment, I explained, had like a crack which initiated at the center. The peel test has a crack which initiates at the edge. So just by the differences in geometry in terms of where we apply the force, we get a tenfold enhancement in the detachment force. And this, nature knows about this too. So for structures that need to make transient adhesive bonds, they tend to have spatulate shapes, which means that thread comes down at the edge and the cracks are initiated at the edge. These tend to be like flies and beetles that make attachments but then come off. Mushroom shapes, which are made by mussels that want to make long attachments, but also ivy and other types of systems that make really extended bonds, they tend to have a thread that comes to the center, and they tend to be stronger because of that. One interesting thing, which we did not expect, was that we see very little dependence on pull speed, right? So I spent like the first 30 minutes talking all about the fact that we saw like very different behaviors in our cytoskeletal networks based on the single molecule properties of the cross-linking bonds, and that in some cases we directly saw readouts of the bond kinetics, in the bond breakage kinetics in our mechanics. And yet here in a case where we see a lot of dissipation, we don't see speed dependencies, right? So this suggests again that this is not really about breaking bonds. There's other types of dissipation that are coming into play. And for those of us that have spent most of our lives doing molecular level mechanics, this was really surprising. But when I talk to my colleagues who are structural materials people, they don't find this surprising at all. And in fact, lots of materials behave this way, even if it's not the way that we normally think about protein structures. And we can pull at different angles, and we in that case do see different modes of failure, as I discussed before, but we don't really see any big difference in the pull rate dependence. So it's possible that this is related to this porous structure, right? That somehow this porous structure allows us to dissipate energy through collapse or changing of this structure in a way that does not rely on breakage of single bonds, rather relies on like deformation of these structures. And there's certainly work that's been done on bone that suggests that that might be true. There's been work done on metal foams. So we're pursuing understanding how these kind of microscale structures give rise, nanoscale and microscale structures might give rise to the types of mechanical behaviors that we see. So this was the first measurement of detachment dynamics for a mushroom, and we can see that this, for mushroom-shaped geometry, and we can see that we get about 1,000-fold enhancement in force than we would by interface energy alone. And I think it's important to recognize that because the muscle world, like the muscle people, spend most of their energy talking about the specific chemistry that's involved, right? These DOPA chemistries, which is a specific type of amino acid that's enriched in these systems that is useful and is important and is used in the surgical glues without any regard to structures. But if we are going to push beyond having just wet glues to having adhesive structures, I think that having these ideas of geometry are really important. And to kind of tie this back into the earlier part of my talk, like having structures that we can control, having architectures and bonding that we can control, having microscale structures that we can control are all pathways for materials design. And I think it really depends on like which way you're looking at it. If you're looking at a cell that has a fixed structure, you can then try to say, well, why might it have that structure based on these materials processes? But from the larger perspective of making new classes of materials, being able to control things like composition and compliance and nano and microscale structure allows us to control the pathways of stress transmission and the pathways of stress dissipation in a way that gives rise to really different and high performance materials. So these are the people who've worked on the muscle project, particularly Ken Desmond, who's a postdoc in my group who just recently took a job at ExxonMobil, and this was done in collaboration with Herb Waite, who's our muscle guru on campus. And I think that's my last slide. So we've had a lot of questions, but any more I'd be happy to take.
Thanks, Megan.
Sure.
Wondering about what you said about this red dependence. I mean, my understanding is with the single molecule red stuff is that you have to have KT help you in order to get red dependence. But if you do macroscopic structure, I guess KT is
And then you just you can't really see it here, right? But here I've shown you these pore structures because that's the thing that I've become most interested in. But in the thread part that goes back to this body, there's a lot of collagen. And the collagen actually creates kind of two structures, one which is disordered and one which is more ordered. And the work that's been done on the single threads does suggest that there's like single molecule unfolding transitions that are occurring that do give you some rate dependence. Now I agree that it's not that thermal energy does have to be important to that model. But the question is, like, when you apply enough force, do you get to kind of a tipping point where then thermal energy gets you over some barrier? And we never see that, right? And so, but if you have, like, if you have force-induced opening of bonds, then I would have expected to see... Yeah. Yeah, I mean, maybe the answer is I shouldn't have been so surprised, I guess. Like, that's possible, too. But I thought that we would see more rate dependence here.
Something, macroscopic brittle fracture, there's no temperature. It doesn't play any role.
Yeah, but this isn't, I agree. But I wouldn't have thought of this as brittle fracture, either. Uh-huh.
I'm a little confused by your picture. You say that those pores play a big role.
I'm throwing out there that I think the pores are cool and are something we haven't thought about before, and they might play a good role.
They're very beautiful. But if I could, I'm trying to understand. Suppose you take that same material and you could make it without pores, just a solid piece, homogeneous material,
yeah.
The same material.
Yeah.
Do you think it'd be weaker?
Maybe.
Oh, come on.
Maybe, why not? I mean, no, really, why not? Right? I mean, you can't expect that if you change the structure in some way that you wouldn't give rise to different materials properties.
But crack propagation is a problem, right? And here you can maybe
the crack
distribute the load.
There are different pathways to force transmission in this system than there would be if it was homogeneous.
You're saying that if you think about brittle fracturations, about in brittle fracture, you concentrate the stress.
Yeah.
And you're saying that you just hang that up.
Maybe. Right? I mean, in brittle fracture, you can get like a crazed zone around the surface, right? And that damage zone then controls a lot of how the crack propagates. And if I can control the pathways for dissipation through this type of structure, then I'm controlling the size of the damage zone. I'm controlling the way that the damage zone spreads as it goes across the crack. So it's not obvious to me that this would be the same as a homogeneous system.
Could you do the experiment? Could you make that homogeneous?
There's two pathways, right? One is to figure out how to make these. I mean, making a homogeneous thing's way easier than making this. If I was going to start with something synthetic, right? It's much easier for me to make a PDMS structure. So we're doing that. I don't have the answer for you at this point. Being able to make structured systems is something that we're working towards. This is part of a large effort in the materials research lab. So I think we'll get there. The other thing that's neat is not all muscles have the same structure. So we may be able to get muscles that have a less foamy structure, and in fact, the ones that have the less foamy structure, as you would have argued, I guess, live in less wavy areas, right? So they tend to be less strong, perhaps, and they have developed a different type of system. So we can exploit it from synthetic pathways, and we can also exploit it by looking at the diversity that biology gives us, and see how that goes. We've only done the California muscles now, Dan.
Can you do kind of iris?
These are large, but these are small, yeah, right?
But if you think these are really, so important, can you do high resolution optical light possibly while you're pulling them?
They're pretty opaque.
Second?
They're pretty opaque. So maybe reflection, maybe, but they're opaque and they have this cuticle on the outside. So I think that the reason that you can see this is because this is a freeze fracture and then an EM on the freeze fracture. So I'm not sure how we would penetrate through. Maybe neutrons, maybe. What do you think? I'll be a beam scientist, Dan. Yeah?
In the network of microtubule electrons, you talked in 2019 bones. How do you know it's just a single bone breaking, or maybe it's just some parallel bone breaking? Because I'm saying this because of the X beta, the nuclear gap is very small, like 0.05 nanometers, 0.5 angstrom.
Yeah.
It seems to be too small, so. How does it compare with the state-of-the-art biotin single molecular forces?
Yeah, it's within. It's within a factor of 3 or 4.
Yeah. So that means maybe 3 or 4 only.
Sure.
Simultaneously,
not sure. Sure, that's possible. Yeah, we don't have that level of precision in the optics, right, to be able to know exactly what would have been broken. I agree it probably isn't just one. It's probably not the same number every time we score kind of a jump event. And it's also, this is different than we get in the compliant cross-linking case, right? Now, the compliant cross-linking case has this disadvantage of having topology of the network also changing. But I still tend to think that the more compliant networks tend to spread the force over a larger range, right? So, but yeah, it may not be one. It doesn't really matter to me if it's one or not, but it's more like one than it is like 1,000, right?
Is it bead size dependence?
We haven't looked at that, so. I don't know. I mean, this would argue, in this case, you'd argue maybe less so, right? Because it's just a few bonds, whereas in the more compliant case, more so, because you're changing the distribution of forces across the network. But we just haven't looked. There's obvious challenges with that in terms of, the maximum forces that you can apply for smaller beads, at least, right? We could go to larger beads, but it's a volumetric control. So going from, 5 microns to 1 micron is a big change in force.
The condition still dropping?
No, I mean, I think the kinesins should rupture. I think you're absolutely right. The kinesins should rupture before the biotin stripped avenue jumps, right? Because this bond should be 10 to 20 piconewtons, and this should be 100. So if there's a failure, it should fail at either end. But we see that we can apply much larger forces. So here we see these big softening effects, which I think is due to bond rupture at around 100 piconewtons. And in the kinesin case, we're getting to hundreds, and we still see a more or less linear regime. So that's the argument against having it be, that the bonds are breaking, that the kinesins are breaking, because that should be happening, if anything, at lower force. So that may be because the stress is distributed over a larger number of them, so that the force that each crosslinker is experiencing is much smaller. Or it could be that now the microtubules have formed bundles, and those bundles are less likely to bend, so that just means a more rigidified system, and we're seeing kind of an entangled, bundled network that is not showing bond breakage dynamics because it doesn't care that it's cross-linked because the bundles themselves are the thing that's sustaining the stress. I think that we should be able to get at that again with the imaging, but we haven't gone there yet. Okay.
So, a little bit confused about the numbers, but if you take a microtubule network at exactly the same concentration of all sorts of chadavidins or kinesins on this two side-by-side comparison, how does the stiffness of the kinesin crossing networks compare to the one of the strip? I mean, is it because you would expect it to be quite a bit softer, right? But the numbers don't seem...
So this is... I don't know if I have the direct comparison. So at 25 micromolar tubulin, the amount of crosslinker that we have is in the range of 0.5 to 6 micromolar, right? And we're seeing stiffnesses that are somewhere between like 200 and 1,000 in this unit. And then if we go here, we have less crosslinker, so they're 0.5, but we have stiffnesses that are sort of in that range. So I've reduced the crosslinker concentration by a factor of 3, but I see kind of similar range of systems. So we haven't done the exact side-by-side, but that's the way to think of it. But it gets back to this question of I don't know the extent to which the crosslinkers are. I could argue either way. I could argue that it's like the compliance of the crosslinkers are giving rise to a spreading out of the force, that now more crosslinkers are engaged, motors in this case, but motors acting as crosslinkers are engaged, and that gives like a larger activated volume of the sample, and that gives rise to a different stiffness. Or I could say the bending stiffness of the single bundles in the kinesin crosslink case is much higher than the bending stiffness of the single filaments, and that's what's giving rise to the differences in stiffness. And we just haven't been able to disentangle those two. So I don't know.
I think there should be beads. So the thermomagnetic beads, I mean, what is their, I mean, in terms of torque? You know, these beads could all roll in there, right? They don't have to be going through straight. They could roll off. In other words, they could rotate. And is there a difference between magnetic tweezers and optical tweezers in terms of torque? Not in terms of force, in terms of torque, you know, the magnetic moment that you are using, the bead is probably quite stiff in terms of rotation.
So these are...
I would suspect that might be wrong.
So we haven't really thought about that in this experiment, but Omar's group, who does the single molecule measurements of DNA, has thought about it. So I can speak a little of what they've learned. So these super paramagnetic beads have small domains of ferromagnetic material, right? But they're small enough that thermal motion is enough to randomize their moments. So in the absence of an external field, it doesn't have a magnetic moment. They just act like latex beads, which is great because they don't form these long chains or anything, right? They just act as non-magnetic particles. But then in the presence of a field, the moments begin to align. And that's why the magnetic moment depends upon the B field, because at some point you saturate and they're all aligned and now you have your maximum value of magnetic moment, but there's a ramp up to that. And that's fairly well understood. So if they're really randomized, then you would expect that there would be no remnant orientation, right? And the orientation would only be set by how you apply the field, in which case they should just move. The internal magnetic moments should rotate, but the bead itself shouldn't rotate, right? Now, in the single molecule measurements, they do see some little bit of rotation, and they can see that by like you pull up and you can see like a little bit of precession of the filament. Yeah, I mean, and that's not my data, so I don't want to speak too much just in terms of exactly what they see, but they see something that suggests that there is like an inherent orientation of the beads, which presumably is due to the way they're manufactured, and it varies from bead to bead. No, I don't think so. I think it's coming from the distribution. Yeah, the distribution of these little like nanoscale domains inside. But we haven't explored that. We also haven't tethered the particles to our network, right? So the particles, in our case, if they do rotate a bit, should just rotate to whatever that new orientation is, and then be fine, I think. So that becomes more of an issue when you're doing torque measurements, right? So they have, like, you can align them with a field, and then you can rotate the way the field goes, and you can twist these systems. And for the DNA work, they do that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, optical tweezers will do that, too. Sure.
you know, when I wrote something, it's like pulling your vibrator of a strong agate, right?
Yeah.
So the forces are quite different.
Yeah, but in the 3D continuum, it's not there at all.
Well, it's at that scale, like 5 microns, is it a 3D continuum with these large, gigantic parts that we have in there?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if it's a 3D continuum anymore.
The phase-separated one, probably not, maybe not, but the...
Entangled.
Regular entangled.
I'm just asking, right?
Yeah, no, it's cool. I haven't thought about that. Yeah, no, it's an interesting point. I haven't thought about that.
So the size might be important, right? What you asked, Christoph.
Yeah.
If you go up in size, nothing should happen. If you go down in size, it might actually matter.
Right? The fact that they're using to rotate the DNA, right? That means there is a connection between the dipole and the...
Yeah, in the applied field, but there's not necessarily like you can apply a field and you get a moment in that applied field, and then if you rotate the direction of the field, you can rotate.
You rotate the bead.
The moment inside the stationary bead.
You actually rotate the bead with a bead. But that's what I meant, yeah. Because the optical techniques, as far as I understand, don't have that issue, right?
So yeah, I don't. I see your point. Yeah.
So I'm saying comparing the two is actually an interesting exercise.
They do that all the time.
They do that all the time. I have to think about how they do it. I see your point. Yeah. I see your point.
Yeah, I was asking because we made little beads for our terminal research where you put little mirrors inside.
Okay.
And these beads are 5 microns.
Okay.
Up to 1,000 microns. And you put little mirrors, basically high index refraction material inside, and
yeah.
Transparent.
Yeah.
And then you can shine light on it and you see the actual.
Oh, that's cool.
You can actually measure the rotation. Now, we use that for fluid dynamics, not
right.
For biophysics.
Right.
So I was wondering whether there are any useful...
I see.
Whether they could be also useful for these kind of questions. That's what I was wondering. That's what I was asking before, actually.
That's cool. Yeah, I haven't...
You can make lots of these. You can use microfluidic beads. You just make a microfluidics, and you can put the little mirrors inside. And
yeah.
You can cook them later. And
Yeah, I don't think people have thought, I mean, I'll have to think about it. I don't think people have thought about it for these types of mechanics measurements, but certainly at the single molecule level where they're tracking motor motion, then there have been measurements of torques, but those are, you know, they're difficult to do. So if you had a new pathway to that, that might be interesting.
When you make the longitudinal networks, do you follow a certain procedure? Do you have to wait? Do you see transients? The other way around. I mean, we have a problem when we do microtubule networks and mix something into them, like crosslinker. We have to wait for about 2 hours before the whole thing becomes stationary.
Yeah, so I think it depends on the... Okay. So let's see. So her normal order of operations would be to polymerize the networks in the presence of the crosslinkers. So she gets she gives the network like a little bit of a head start. So she'll start by allowing like nucleation to occur, but then she'll add the crosslinkers and allow all of the network to form in the presence of the crosslinkers. And these are in small volume capillary tubes. So we're only using like maybe 15 microliters of solution, and then the magnetic beads are in there as well. So then those capillary tubes are sealed, and we put them in an incubator, and we rotate them so that the beads don't settle, and that goes on for like half an hour to an hour. Now, she has, in some of the cases where I said like the phase separation occurs really quickly, she did do that like on the fly, where she was able to kind of inject really quickly and see what happens. And she saw those structures form quickly, but we haven't tracked the mechanics of that. And if she keeps them in the incubator for an hour and then she usually does confocal first and then she does the mechanical measurements, because she wants to make sure all of the structures are assessed by confocal before she does the mechanical measurement, just in case something goes wrong. So that would be like, I would guess, at least 2 hours before she's doing the mechanical testing. So if there aren't huge structural evolution that occurs during that time, because we would see that, I guess, but we're not measuring the mechanical properties during that time. We haven't seen differences like 2 hours to 6 hours. The next day, they're not really so great, right? Yeah. So I mean, you can do it, but I don't. We try to do everything within about 6 hours or so, 8 hours.
Exhausted curiosity.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.